This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and it's Pressing Matters, the show that goes behind the headlines. Often we speak to people who are news making the news as well, not newsmakers, but people who are writing the news or delivering it to us. Today, our guest is S. Jayasankaran. He's a journalist. He's got currently a column with The Star. It comes out on Saturday. It's called Speakeasy. And for those of us who are long in the tooth, we will remember him for his work at the Far Eastern Economic Review. He was there from 1994 until its closure in 2004. He also has written for the Asian Wall Street Journal and also Singapore Business Times. Thank you so much, Jaya, for being with us. We interviewed you some 3 years ago, I believe. I came to your apartment, and that was aired some 3 years ago.
Ah, interesting. Well, I only joined BFM over the last year or so, so this is my first time meeting you. Certainly interested to get your thoughts now that here we are, 2.5 weeks post GE14. Let's start there then, Jayasankaran. You know, like, what do you make of it all? Has it fully sunk in yet?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for inviting me. In the first place, to be honest, just a few days before GE14, my wife and I, more my wife than me, were expecting a change. Everybody we talked to were talking about a change. And I remember on the night, we had a small party, election night party, friends. And the results started coming in. I mean, although they were slowing it down but, you know, I was a former journalist. You call people, you get it. And we could see that there was a major, I mean, for lack of a better word, a tsunami sweeping. And I remember we were cheering and clapping and tearing. I mean, it was quite dramatic.
I mean, you mentioned your wife, and I know, of course, that she was a high-ranking member of the civil service. She was with the Ministry of International Trade and Industry. Interesting, because there you are, a journalist, you know, sharing, as it were, a proverbial or literal bed with somebody in government. Was it difficult? I mean, just this is a side story, but was it difficult dealing with that conundrum? Not many of us sleep with the enemy, as it were.
That's a bad metaphor. But anyway, you could say that my wife was, as you know, is Rebecca. And for the longest time, when she was in the civil service, especially when I joined the Review, we tried to keep our marriage separate. I wouldn't go for her functions and she wouldn't come for mine. And it was difficult, I mean. But then the Review closed in 2004, and then the problem was about 2007 odd, she began getting promoted very rapidly. And that sort of was a hairy situation for me in Singapore Business Times.
And she's a double dato, and so does it make you a double datin?
I'm a Ponsri, actually.
Well, but look, you know, for somebody who is so experienced in the media industry, surely you know the perception that a journalist is only as good as his or her sources, right? So I'm sure you were able to leverage that relationship somehow.
Oh, it's no, not really. I tried my best never to write about anything meaty.
Okay, coming back to...
In fact, I never did, actually.
You never did. Okay, coming back to GE14, I mean, I know you've retired as a journalist, but you must have been keeping your finger on the pulse at some, you know, it's a obsession, I think. It becomes part of our personality as a journalist. Was this something expected or unexpected for you?
What was unexpected?
The results of GE14.
No, it was not unexpected. We were expecting, I mean, at least the immediate group of friends that I had. In fact, I took a bet with a very senior lawyer, $100, and I won it. To be fair, he paid.
So what is it that led you to the unusual conclusion that the country would see a new government?
I don't think it is unusual. For one thing, everybody I know, except for one guy, but anyway, in our group, generally seemed to think that everybody he knew seemed to think that Barisan was going to lose. You know, and I had friends in other states. I called them. Then I belong to this club, and I speak to them, and they say everybody they know think they're going to lose. So you right. seem to think that there was a maybe what Lee Hua Beng called that Dr. Mahathir will unleash a tsunami. And in actual fact, that's what happened if you think about it. There was a Malay tsunami of sorts, except that a lot of them, the Malay tsunami went to Pakatan Harapan and to PAS. Well, it is only UMNO that didn't get it.
Yeah, so there appears to be this disconnect, and we've been trying to analyze this over the last 2.5 weeks, right? Because in the lead up to GE14, we spoke to many a political analyst, and pretty much all of them wrote off Pakatan Harapan, or at least didn't really give them much of a fighting chance going to GE14. So there appears to be this disconnect between what political analysts were publicly saying versus, you know, like you just mentioned, and having your ear to the ground, what the layman is saying, right? So, and as a journalist, like, how do you strike
the balance? I think it's because of this tremendous perception that Fortress Barisan would never be breached. They would either cheat, or they would use money, or they would use something. It would not fall. You know what I mean? Mm. The whole, there would be no breach. So they just fell into that belief. Mm. You know. So although in their heart they thought, this cannot be. Everybody's telling me they're going to lose.
Right.
So they think, oh, they must be cheating. Right. They would cheat their way out of it.
But employing your journalistic, say, instincts then, or at least... Yeah.
But this is not really journalistic instinct. By that time, I had retired. I just knew people, my old sources and stuff.
How much credit do you give...
And you've got to admit, people, you know the Dayem Zainuddin, they call him the Oracle, Tun Dayem. When he said it, a lot of people started taking notice, you know.
I wonder, though, you know, the question of credit. Now, a lot of people are giving Dr. Mathe credit for this win. Do you think he's taking too much credit for it?
No, I think he's allowed. Look, at 08, 13, they needed 30 seats odd to take them over the top, right? They never had it. And how did they get it in the end? And you could say Dr. Mathe was the one who engineered this perfect storm, you could say. He was the icing on the cake. There was a perfect storm. You know, and what did Dr. Mahathir do? He was very crafty. He allowed this thing. He used rising prices, GST, and equated it as a consequence of corruption, which is the 700-pound gorilla in the room, 1MDB. And that was so simple. It resonated on the Malay heartland, the ground. And everybody bought it. Oh, they said, that's it. It is not this big, huge, complex thing that we thought about. No, it's just GST equals, because of this corruption, we got to pay for it, so we introduce GST.
Right.
Simple, bingo.
Okay, so actually a lot of this turns on the personality of Dr. Mathe, his skill as a communicator and so forth.
Beautiful.
Now, you've interviewed him before in your past. Tell us a little bit about the man that you encountered close up and personal.
He's a remarkable man. I mean, you have to admit, he's remarkable. In the first place, you know, when people listen to you, I mean, I think, he'll say development when he knows it's development. And he does it just, I think, to irritate you. You know? And he uses words. His English is actually quite extraordinary. He's got a great grasp. I remember once I was talking to him about the interview was getting a bit heated. And my question actually said, the judiciary is fiercely independent, and would you comment? But this time he seemed to be getting irritated, so I thought, you know, in this discretion being the better part of valor, I omitted the word fiercely independent. So the judiciary in Malaysia is said to be independent. He said, no, let's get it straight. You used the word fiercely independent. He remembered it. Then he used the word in the same breath, he used the word excoriate, which I was quite stunned, you know. I mean, which guy uses the word excoriate?
Right.
In spoken language. I mean, he's a remarkably smart fellow. He's got a very good sense of humor. You know? I remember a BBC journalist asked him just before in the 1995 election or 94. And they said, asked him what he's dictating, being a dictator. And he looked at him and he said, very wryly, I thought, he said, well, I must be the only dictator in history to have to be elected before I can begin dictating, which I thought was rather funny, actually.
But he did have an issue. There were issues around his authoritarian ways.
Yes, there's no doubt about it.
And the subject of that heated conversation you had with him, was it around the kind of choices he was making? He was a nationalist, but he had a particular way of dealing with national development, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, he felt that he was, in a lot of ways, he was like Lee Kuan Yew and Thatcher. You know, he didn't like the wets. You know what I mean? He thought these fellas, it's all the chef, you know. You know,
the wets being kind of woolly-headed, soft, liberal.
Idealistic liberals with their heads in the clouds and not knowing the big picture, which he knew. capital H, capital K, you know? These were all wets. You know, for him, the dogs may bark, but the caravan moves on, you know? Ancient Arab saying.
Right, but from your years of writing and in your interviews with him, right, how were you able to, say, look past the theatrics or the showboating or the fancy wordplay and actually get to the heart of the matter? Or did you find that disarming in your interactions with him?
Sometimes he could be very intimidating, actually. I'm not sure the word disarming. He could be very intimidating.
But because you're using words like, you know, it's funny, you know, you see
that. But there was no doubt he was an authoritarian. What he did with the judiciary was not very good at all. What he did to the... I think he Malayized the civil service too much, in my opinion. I mean, compared to when he inherited it. And what else could you say? I mean, he used institutions rather ruthlessly. But I suppose, look at what he's doing now. That's part of his, I suppose, his Machiavellian thing. That there are no permanent friends or permanent enemies. There are only permanent interests. And for him now, his interest is to get this country back on track because he thinks it's been ruined.
And we're speaking to S. Jayasankaran, a journalist. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Tan Chung An. And it's Pressing Matters. Our guest this morning, S. Jayasankaran, a retired journalist, still writing. He's got a column in The Star on Saturdays called Speakeasy, because well known for his work in Far Eastern Economic Review, the Singapore Business Times as well. We were talking about Dr. Mahathir before the break, Jaya, and you have personal insights because you've interviewed him on many occasions. But there was one moment in time when you had a kind of closed-door encounter with him, and this was in 1994 with Kem Bena Perdana Negara. You were invited to this. Tell us about it. You were invited because you were seen to be an influence or influential, or the language of today, an influencer.
Yeah, without the Instagrams or the Facebooks or the Twitter. Yeah, so you were a leading voice in society, Jaya. So talk to us about that.
But I don't think it's leading or in so much. There were a lot of us there anyway. I was just a small cog. But the thing is, what I remember is some of the questions. It was interesting. And Dr. Mahathir was very, very frank. Basically, the thing was, I was not supposed to talk about it, but now it's like 20 years after the fact. I think nobody bothers. The point is, you could ask any question you wanted. So when I was there, I think it was one lady who appeared to know him very well. She asked a question of, was there increasing Islamization of the civil service? And she felt that, and should they worry? Everybody here, by the way, the audience was principally non-Malay. And Dr. Mahathir looked at her quite seriously and said, yes, it is. And he said, it can happen to me. I'm supposed to be the prime minister, right? He said, I can do anything I like. I mean, he's being sarcastic, but I can't, he said. So he said there was this example of a friend, must have been hell of a friend because you could just get him. He wanted to set up a church in Ipoh. And according to the law, if the congregation raises 100,000, the government is supposed to give you a matching grant and you can open this. You know, he had the land, he just wanted the grant. So Mahathir said, no problem, go ahead. And he said, that is it, I thought. And he said, 3 months later, this guy called and it didn't happen. And Dr. Mahathir was furious, so he called the MB and he said, so what? He said, MB said, I didn't want to tell you this, but you know, the civil servant rejected it because it's Islamic. Right? And Dr. Mahathir then asked the audience, well, what should we do? And people said, sack him and transfer him or this and that, you know, everything. Then he said, that's why you're not a politician. He said, if I had sacked him or done it, he'll become an issue and he'll be on front page on Haraka. Then he said, you people don't realize one thing, he said. And this struck me as quite important, I thought. He said, you seem to think Kit Siang will never be prime minister. But he said, Tunku Razali might. So could Nick Aziz. And his point is very clear. He knew this. And we didn't. You know what I mean?
Right. But was he a trailblazer?
Just to finish the thing. Said in the end, he sorted it out and the guy got the land in Gopeng, which is very close to Ipoh, and the guy didn't mind, and everything went well.
Right.
And I think the civil servant in question was transferred very quietly, very much later, after the fact.
So do you think that mindset was, championed by Tun Dr. Mahathir and Dato Sri Anwar at that point in time? Keeping in mind, this camp was 24 years ago. Yeah, 24 years ago. So was that where you perhaps you saw the birthing of the increased Islamization of the civil service, as you put it?
No, I think this was a function. It was happening anyway, you know. I mean, if you remember, when I went to university, there was one lady there with the head covered. And this was in 1975. Then the Ayatollah fell and, you know, the whole thing started, right? So it would have happened anyway. Mm.
So it was broader forces that perhaps shaped Tunduk Mati and Dato' Sri Anwar's stance more so than the other way around.
Yes. Mm.
Well, coming back to the present, we have Dr. Mahathir return as the Prime Minister. It's extraordinarily ironic for some. Do you think that the core, at his core, he remains the same man? Has he looked back at his administration that many people, including yourself, were quite critical of? Do you think he's going to undo much of the problems that he, in some ways, is credited for starting?
I think he has not changed. But, I mean, and that is maybe his strength. You see, he's pragmatic enough to know that maybe this is the best way. And because he's a pragmatist, above all, he says, okay, if this is the way I have to make friends with Kit Siang, I have to reconcile with Anwar, so be it. This is the only way I'm going to do it, right? So let's do it. And if he's willing to accept all these things, which his, shall I say now, his new colleagues are foisting on him, which is reform of the judiciary, reform of the civil service, reform of all, you know, get everybody back in line. Let's get back on track. Get our finances back on track. No more nonsense. So be it, yes. And that's good because he's a pragmatist above all else. And thank God for that.
So he's a pragmatist who said that Lim Kit Siang could never be Prime Minister of Malaysia, but Lim Guan Ying is now Finance Minister. Did you find that an interesting move on the part of his cabinet?
Well, don't forget, I'm 62 years old. I remember a time that I thought that a Chinese would always be Finance Minister. When I was in my formative years, Tan Siew Sin was the Finance Minister. He when I was in university, just before I went to university, Tan Siew Sin finally retired. And by that time, he had been Prime Minister, Finance Minister from 1957. It was a long time.
Right. And so this was the crux of my chat earlier with YB Lim Kit Siang, right? You know, where do you draw the line between principles and political expediency? So, Jaya, based on what you have described, Tun Mahathir, it's all about what is politically pragmatic. Those, and I'm using air quotes here, principles that changes with the times. Am I reading this correctly? Does he have inherent principles that he really sticks to no matter what?
I think he realizes that there's a great deal wrong now with Malaysian society. There's a great deal wrong. The amount of corruption is gone. It's gone bonkers. It's gone awry. You got to fix it. I mean, the genie has come out of the bottle. You got to cork it. You got to put it back.
Speaking of genies and the spin masters of, you know, that apparently were going to help deliver Barisan Nasional win, the media that was aligned to the previous administration and government failed them in many ways. And now we have a whole new landscape. How do you think the old media, especially those who are politically linked, that thought their role was to support those in power regardless, what do you think is going to happen now?
I think it's best if you look at what's happening to the Star now, for example. Okay, you could say the first day they were in shock, fine. But they've recovered quite well, and now they're just writing what they're supposed to write in the first place. They're reporting very factually. That's good. That's very good.
But isn't their credibility shot?
Well,
full of holes?
People have to continue to read something, right? I'm now watching Astro Awani. That's ridiculous. I never watched it in my life before. Now I prefer it to CNN.
Right. And these newfound freedoms, so to speak.
It's wonderful.
Enough to entice you back out of retirement?
But you should read my column.
You slaughtered that.
Sorry. Made me laugh. But you should read my column.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me giving a plug. It's right. Not bad at all, even if I say so myself.
Yeah, but I'm sure there'll be many more opportunities for someone with, you know, your experience in this new media landscape, right?
You're a youthful 62. I mean, Dr. Mahathir has established a new norm when it comes
to
being
productive.
True, there's
hope for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, he's at 93, he's still working very hard.
That's quite true. There's hope for all of us.
What would your advice be to a young journalist, especially those who now have no reason to, you know, indulge in self-loathing that used to mark the profession? What's your advice for them?
That's not bad. It's well put. They're lucky guys. I mean, the world's their oyster now, man. Go and get it.
Okay, thank you so much, Jaya. That was Jaya Sankaran, a journalist well known for his work at the Far Eastern Economic Review, the Singapore Business Times. Also, currently has a column with the Star. Comes out on Saturday. It's called Speakeasy. It's a humor column. And if you know Jaya's humor, it harkens back to an older time, an older, gentler time where puns. This is why, Han, you like it.
Yeah.
Full of puns and a play on language. Thank you again, Jeff, for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han. And coming up to the top of the hour, we'll be back with Enterprise. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.